KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
What we know and what questions remain about the plane crash that marks the nation's worst air disaster in a generation.
For Thursday, January 30th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Ahead this hour, senators have questions for Kash Patel.
Patel has attacked the agency he wants to leave.
I do think you have an assignment from Donald Trump to gut the FBI. You said yourself, I'll shut down the FBI Hoover building.
We'll also check on another fraught confirmation hearing today for Tulsi Gabbard, Trump's pick for America's top intelligence post.
Plus, I ask one of the top execs at OpenAI what he makes of Chinese AI startup DeepSeek.
This makes really clear that there is a real competition and a real race.
These stories and more after today's news headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Donald Trump says former President Joe Biden's DEI policies could be to blame for the deadly mid-air crash last night involving a flight from Wichita, Kansas, coming into Washington, D.C. Biden's former transportation secretary shot back that Trump had fired and suspended key safety personnel, but federal officials pointing fingers. Wichita leaders want to unify the community. KMUW's Celia Hack reports.
Wichita is home to a large aviation community. At a prayer service here, local elected officials and religious leaders spoke about rising above division and grief. Ryan Beatty, a Republican, is chair of the Sedgwick County Commission.
All eyes are on Wichita in many regards. When they see Wichita, what I hope they see is they see a community rising above those conversations, kicking out politics. I think we have an opportunity here to demonstrate how you love, to demonstrate how you mourn.
Wichita Mayor Lily Wu, a libertarian, said she was proud that residents from a diversity of backgrounds, religions, and races came together at the prayer service to mourn. For NPR News, I'm Celia Hack in Wichita.
President Trump's nominee to head the FBI came under intense questioning on Capitol Hill today. Kash Patel coming under fire regarding what some termed an enemies list. He denied there is such a list and also said the Bureau under his leadership would not seek retribution against Trump's adversaries or launch political motivated investigations.
If confirmed as the next FBI director, I will remain focused on the FBI's core mission. That is to investigate fully wherever there is a constitutional factual basis to do so.
Democrats also confronted Patel about his statements about the January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol. In response, he said there can never be a tolerance for violence against law enforcement. The National Science Foundation has stopped funding existing research grants. As Jonathan Lambert explains, it's pausing payments as it works to comply with Trump administration executive orders.
Hundreds of scientists who receive direct funding from NSF for their livelihoods are unable to get paid right now, and the research funds that go to institutions and universities are in limbo. NSF is congressionally mandated to consider how its grants will boost underrepresented groups' participation in science. That mandate is at odds with Trump's executive orders aiming to terminate diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts across the government. The National Science Foundation has an annual budget of around $9 billion to fund research grants. Payments of those grants have been paused since Tuesday as the agency reviews their grant making and the projects they fund. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
A rebound in the tech sector helped lead much of the market higher today. All three of the major U.S. stock market indexes gaining ground. The Dow closed up 168 points to 44,882. The NASDAQ was up 49 points. This is NPR. The Hamas militant group announced today it's released 8 more hostages being held in Gaza in exchange for another 110 prisoners. Latest release, part of a ceasefire deal negotiated earlier this month. The hostages were released during a chaotic handover as an unruly crowd stood on the sidelines. The prisoner swap was briefly placed on hold by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who demanded mediators assure the safe exit of the hostages. The United Parcel Service says it will deliver fewer packages from its biggest customer, Amazon, moving forward. As Marlon Hyde from member station WABE reports, UPS released its 2024 quarterly earnings today.
UPS reported revenue of more than $25 billion for the fourth quarter of 2024, a 1.5% increase from the previous year. The company says it plans to reduce volume with its largest customer, Amazon, by 50% in the second half of 2026. It's part of an initiative to cut costs and save UPS around $1 billion. Here's CEO Carol Tomei.
Amazon is our largest customer, but it's not our most profitable customer. Its margin is very dilutive to the U.S. domestic business.
UPS expects sales of about $89 billion for 2025. For NPR News, I'm Marlon Hyde in Atlanta.
The reports of increased volcanic activity at a popular tourist destination in Greece, the island of Santorini. An announcement this week, the country's climate crisis and civil protection ministry saying monitoring sensors have picked up mild seismic volcanic activity there. Similar volcanic activity was reported in 2011, lasting for 14 months, but ending without any issues. I'm Jack Speer, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting books, radio, podcasts, film, television, theater, and more to bridge science and the humanities. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. On a difficult day here in Washington, as investigators try to understand why an Army Black Hawk helicopter and an American Airlines regional jet collided in midair.
Tower of the Secret 342 on Mount Vernon, visual runway 1.
American Eagle Flight 5342 was preparing to land at Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport just before 9 last night. It sounded like a routine approach, as you can hear on this recording provided by liveatc.net.
526, runway 33. Yeah, we can do 33 for Boosie.
Moments later, an air traffic controller asks the helicopter pilot if he can see the approaching plane.
That's 25, this is your GM flight.
The pilot says yes. The helicopter pilot was told to go behind the plane. That is not what happened. The two aircraft collided over the Potomac River.
Crash, crash, crash. This is alert 3. Crash, crash, crash. This is alert 3.
Hundreds of first responders searched for survivors overnight in the frigid water. None of the 67 people on the two aircraft survived, which makes this the deadliest disaster in U.S. airspace in decades. NPR's Tom Bowman and Joel Rose have both been following the investigation. They are both with me now. Joel, I'm going to let you kick us off. Federal safety investigators held a briefing today. What did they say?
The National Transportation Safety Board gave its first public update on the investigation. Board Chair Jennifer Homendy promised a thorough investigation, one that will follow the facts. And she was asked several times to speculate about the possible causes of the collision, and she asked for patience.
You need to give us time. We need to verify information to make sure it is accurate. That's best for you. That's important for the families. It's important for legislators who are seeking answers.
Investigators did say the passenger jet plunged into the Potomac River in a, quote, quick, rapid impact, unquote. The NTSB later announced that it has recovered the so-called black boxes from the plane, the cockpit voice and flight data recorders. And investigators think the helicopter had one of these recording devices, too, that could offer more clues about what happened.
Yeah, on the helicopter, Tom Bowman, you cover the military. This was a military Black Hawk helicopter. What do we know about it?
Well, Mary Louise, the Black Hawk was on an annual proficiency training flight out of Fort Belvoir, Virginia, just south of Washington. It had a crew of three, a male instructor pilot with 1,000 hours of flight time, considered experience, and a woman co-pilot with 500 hours, considered normal for a pilot. There was also a male crew member aboard. All had night vision goggles. The Black Hawk was heading south along the Potomac in the direction of National Airport, and like the plane was in touch with the tower. Now, there's a flight corridor for helicopters, and the maximum height is 200 feet. But sources I talked with say it appears a Black Hawk was flying higher, maybe more than 100 feet higher at the time of the crash. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth would only say there was some sort of an elevation issue. The investigation, of course, will determine whether the helicopter was in the corridor and at the right altitude.
Say more about that. Are there working theories for what might have been going on with that?
Well, I spoke with Brad Bowman. He's a defense analyst and former Black Hawk pilot who commanded a company and flew this very same route after the 9/11 attacks. He says in these kinds of proficiency flights, an instructor pilot can sometimes test the less experienced pilot, watching to see, you know, how the pilot responds to different situations. But he said such a technique is probably not a good idea in such a busy area. And of course, if the helicopter was flying that much higher, the instructor should have corrected it immediately.
Joel Rose, we have about a minute left, and I want people just to remember the history here, because the accident sadly ends a remarkable streak. No major plane crashes for many years in the U.S. There have been close calls, though.
Exactly. The last major accident was back in 2009 in Buffalo, when 50 people were killed. This has been really an unprecedented era of safety for air travel in the U.S. But that said, there have been signs of strain in the aviation system, especially as traffic rebounded sharply after the COVID pandemic. We have seen a number of close calls on runways and near airports all over the country, and concern about a shortage of air traffic controllers. We don't know yet if that was a factor here. I want to stress that. The NTSB will hopefully give us an answer, just maybe not as quickly as everyone wants.
NPR's Joel Rose and Tom Bowman, thanks to you both.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
President Trump's nominee to lead the FBI, Kash Patel, has spent the past few years as a fierce critic of federal law enforcement. He's even proposed closing the FBI building and turning it into a museum for the deep state. Patel's confirmation hearing was today on Capitol Hill, and Democrats asked him about that provocative suggestion and had many other questions. NPR's justice correspondent Carrie Johnson followed the confirmation hearing, and she's with us now in the studio to tell us what she heard. Hi, Carrie.
Hi there.
What did Kash Patel say about his priorities for the FBI?
He says he wants to focus on fighting terrorism and violent crime, preventing the flow of fentanyl and other illegal drugs, and to give the good cops the leeway to do their jobs. Patel talked about his 16 years in public service as a public defender, a prosecutor, a national security aide, but he really has a lot less legal and management experience than most of the previous eight FBI directors. And in the first Trump administration, then Attorney General Bill Barr said Patel was unqualified and would get a job at the FBI over his dead body.
Patel is considered a loyal ally to President Trump, but traditionally there has been expected to be a separation between the White House and the FBI. So the loyalty, you wonder how that will the separation be honored. How did Patel respond to questions about that today?
Well, in 2023, he wrote a book called Government Gangsters that included the names of 60 people he said were part of the deep state. And that got Senate Democrats really worried that Kash Patel would use the enormous power of the FBI to go after Donald Trump's political enemies. Here's how Patel responded today.
I have no interest, no desire, and will not, if confirmed, go backwards. There will be no politicization at the FBI. There will be no retributive actions taken by any FBI should I be confirmed as the FBI director.
And other Democrats asked whether Patel knew about any plans to fire FBI agents who investigated Trump. He said no. There's only one political appointee at the FBI. That's the director. But Democrats suggested there's already been a break with that long tradition to bring into the bureau people with ties to Patel, Donald Trump, and the billionaire Elon Musk.
I understand there was one area where Kash Patel seemed to break with President Trump. Tell us about that.
It was January 6th. On his first day in office, Trump pardoned or shortened the prison terms for more than 1,500 people charged with crimes in the attack on the U.S. Capitol 4 years ago. That includes rioters who beat police with bats and flagpoles and bear spray. Here's what Kash Patel had to say about those clemencies.
I do not agree with the commutation of any sentence of any individual who committed violence against law enforcement.
And Patel has had a history of supporting some of those defendants, which is why January 6th was such a key thing to discuss today.
That's exactly right. Patel helped promote a song by what's been called the J6 Choir. That's a group of rioters who had been detained in the same D.C. jail. Here he is talking with Senator Richard Durbin, a Democrat from Illinois, about that.
Well, it's not my choir. It's simply a recording that was utilized to raise funds for families in need of nonviolent offenders.
Who sings on this recording?
I don't know, Senator.
But Patel is actually listed as a promoter of the choir, and at least five of the members pleaded guilty to attacking police. One of them sprayed Officer Brian Sicknick with chemicals. That officer died the next day after suffering a stroke.
Carrie, any sense of Patel's prospects in the Senate?
Republicans have the votes if they all stick together, and all the Republicans on the committee today seemed in line with Kash Patel.
That's NPR Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson. Thanks, Carrie.
The Rwandan-backed M23 rebels have consolidated their hold on Goma in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, or DRC. Once again, the region is on the edge of full-blown regional conflict, as Kate Bartlett reports.
The Serena Hotel, Goma's five-star establishment, sits on picturesque Lake Kivu and is a favorite haunt of foreign correspondents, UN workers, and mercenaries alike. On Thursday, it hosted another group. The Rwandan-backed M23 militia that are now in control of the city held their first press conference. We are in Goma to stay, Corneille Nyanga, one of the group's leaders, declared. He added that the M23 would, quote, continue the march of liberation to Kinshasa, the Congolese capital. The militia group is already advancing rapidly towards another provincial capital, Bukavu.
Mes très chers compatriotes,
in an address to the nation last night, Congo's president, Felix Tshisekedi, vowed his army will prevail. Be sure of one thing, he said, we will fight and we will triumph. The president stopped short of declaring war on Rwanda, a small neighboring country with outsized clout in the international community. This conflict has its roots in the 1994 genocide in Rwanda, in which nearly 1 million, mainly Tutsis, were killed by Hutu extremists. Tutsi rebels, led by current Rwandan President Paul Kagame, put an end to the killing, and many Hutu perpetrators fled across the border to Congo.
Is there anybody among us who did not see this coming? I, for one, I saw it coming.
Kagame has never acknowledged Rwanda's role in the recent conflict, but many others, including the UN and US, say it is involved. While Kagame claims he's protecting Rwanda, Congo's government says Rwanda aims to pillage its vast mineral wealth. DRC is rich in cobalt and other critical minerals essential for the production of smartphones and other devices. As the M23 advances, the politicians squabble and the international community issues calls for calm. It's the Congolese people who suffer, as they have been for decades. Goma was already home to almost 1 million displaced people. Now, many of them are fleeing war once again. For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. These first days of the second Trump administration are bringing big changes to a lot of things, including the business of artificial intelligence. Day two brought the announcement of Stargate. That's a $500 billion AI infrastructure project. It's a private venture, though President Trump unveiled it at the White House and is throwing his support behind it. Then there's all the hullabaloo about the Chinese startup DeepSeek. And today, OpenAI, the company behind ChatGPT, also a big part of Stargate, announced it is partnering with the U.S. National Laboratories to supply the government with advanced models for things like cybersecurity, energy infrastructure, and nuclear security. Well, Chris Lehane is OpenAI's chief global affairs officer. He's here in D.C. where OpenAI made this announcement today. Chris Lehane, welcome.
Mary Louise, thanks for having me.
Start with this new partnership with the National Labs. In a few sentences, why is this a big deal and what is the time frame for it bearing fruit?
Yeah, we do think this is a really significant announcement. In short form, it is OpenAI bringing its leading edge innovation, bleeding edge AI technology into the United States' national labs. It will be critical as those labs move forward in the development of research and development. It will support national security imperatives. But at the end of the day, what it's really bringing is our leading edge tech, the innovation that we're building, and making sure that we're doing it in collaboration, in partnership with the U.S. government, the labs. So.
Let me turn you to Stargate, this huge new $500 billion joint venture that has just been announced. Yeah. OpenAI is a key player in Stargate. As simply as you can explain, what is Stargate and why do we need it?
Stargate is infrastructure is destiny. At the end of the day, the U.S. and the People's Republic of China are in a race, a competition to see who ultimately leads in AI. Right now, the U.S. has a lead. It's not a huge lead, but we do have a lead. Ultimately, what will determine who wins this competition, who wins this race, and the stakes could not be bigger. It really is, are we going to build the world on democratic, free AI, or is it going to be authoritarian, autocratic AI? And what will decide that is something called compute. And compute is, if you add up the following pieces, chips, data, talent, and energy. And if you put that full stack together, that represents infrastructure. It's a 21st century AI infrastructure. And so what we announced last week with President Trump, with our partners at Oracle and SoftBank, is a $500 billion investment in U.S. AI infrastructure to generate that compute, which will help ensure that the U.S. maintains its lead in AI.
It sounds lofty. Will Stargate do something, create something useful to the average American?
Yeah, for a typical American, first of all, there's going to be hundreds of thousands of jobs created just by the construction of this. We've already begun a project in Abilene, Texas. There will be other states that will get pulled in. But what this also means, because there will be access to compute, is that the technology that's being generated by AI will be accessible in a much broader way to many Americans. Think about education, bringing AI into schools to give teachers tools to help educate kids even better. Think about healthcare, the ability to make sure people have access to healthcare that will potentially have significant impacts and the ability to diagnose ailments, challenges, diseases at a much earlier stage. Think about this in science. The deep research capacity is going to allow for incredible advancements.
Does it need to be this expensive? $500 billion is a lot of money, and DeepSeek, the Chinese AI startup, has prompted a conversation about whether foreign rivals are doing things a lot cheaper than American companies.
So first of all, I think when you think about DeepSeek, I do think you have to acknowledge it's a pretty impressive tool that was released. Now, we released a version of this 4 or 5 months ago, and we'll continue to release updated versions where we're demonstrating that OpenAI is helping the U.S. to maintain its lead. I think we'll also learn a lot more information over the next couple of weeks that may reshape our thinking about exactly what we know about the model.
But at this point, you see it as a worthy competitor?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think no matter what, like, I think this makes really clear that there is a real competition and a real race. And so when you talk about the $500 billion, I think really important to understand this is not U.S. taxpayer money. This is not public money. This is private sector money because there's an understanding that as AI continues to move forward, there's going to be more and more and more of a demand for the AI, which then requires more and more and more compute.
Just to stay with this week's news, because there's a lot of things to keep up with here.
Yep.
DeepSeek, the Chinese startup, which I will note dethroned ChatGPT, your AI app, this week is the most downloaded free app in the U.S. Apple Store. Your company says it is investigating whether DeepSeek inappropriately used OpenAI data. Where does that stand?
Yeah, so we're in the process of reviewing to understand totally what may or may not have occurred. There is something that happens in the AI world called distillation, and distillation is a complex idea, but you know, effectively, can people send a lot of stuff at your models and be able to take information out of it and then use that information to replicate something else? There's also a version of distillation.
I did want to ask, what is the difference between a rival company like DeepSeek possibly accessing your data and you training your own products like ChatGPT on other people's work without their permission?
So it's important to sort of bifurcate, you know, where you're doing distillation and someone is taking information and exactly replicating what you do versus distillation. Look, we provide things through our API and other sources so developers can actually distill our tech and build off of them. Those are two very different things. I mean, maybe a way to think about it is I go to the library, borrow a book, I can read that book and return the book. I have certain information. Great. Something else, if you go to the library, take the book, never return the book, put the book out under your name, right? Those are sort of the two different ways to potentially think about this. But
Scarlett Johansson would have thoughts on this.
Yeah. But I think the big point, I think, in all of this is that there is a real competition between the U.S. and China.
Have you tried DeepSeek?
I personally have not. I've seen it. And I think amongst the things that they did and I thought was smart was they put out what's called a chain of thought. So you can actually see how the technology is doing what we call reasoning. You know, OpenAI released something called O1 back in September that has the same tech. We actually think ours continues to be ahead, and we're going to be releasing some additional models, including O3, which comes out on Friday. So I think important to keep in mind, you know, we as the U.S., because of OpenAI, continue to maintain a lead. We need the infrastructure because infrastructure is destiny here if the U.S. wants to win this race.
Crystal Hayne, Chief Global Affairs Officer at OpenAI, thanks very much.
Mary Louise, thanks so much for having me.
This is NPR News.
The tech founder Reid Hoffman watched many tech leaders take the inauguration stage with the new president he had opposed. Hoffman says he's okay with that.
If I were to pick one industry that I would most want to be in dialogue with the president's office and with the American government, it's the tech industry.
But is he worried about retribution? A tech leader who was not invited tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Thank you.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Coming up, the latest in our conversations with first-time Grammy nominees.
Radhika Vakharia told us about growing up in London in a home filled with music.
I was around music from even, you know, when I was in the womb, my parents were having music parties in their homes.
That's ahead. First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. On Capitol Hill, President Trump's pick to be Director of National Intelligence faced pointed questions this afternoon in her confirmation hearing. Tulsi Gabbard is a former Democrat, a congresswoman from Hawaii. She was asked whether she still supports the NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden, whom she has called brave. As a lawmaker, Gabbard introduced a bill to grant Snowden clemency.
As the president's principal intelligence advisor, I'll begin by leading by example, checking my own personal views at the door and committing to delivering intelligence that is collected, analyzed, and reported without bias, prejudice, or political influence.
President Trump's choice to lead the FBI, meanwhile, Kash Patel also had his first confirmation hearing today. After criticizing the Justice Department and FBI before being tapped by Trump to run the bureau. The administration has begun carrying out the president's executive order aimed at eliminating what Trump and his allies call gender ideology from the government. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben tells us the memo would greatly restrict federal workers who identify as transgender and non-binary.
Among other things, the memo says any workers whose job involves, quote, promoting gender ideology will be placed on administrative leave. It also directs agencies to ensure that forms ask for sex and not gender, and also that intimate spaces like workplace showers are designated by biological sex and not gender. The executive order that prompted the memo declares it false that a person can identify with a gender that differs from the sex they were assigned at birth. The agency did not respond immediately to NPR requests for details on how the order will be carried out. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
Stocks finished higher on Wall Street today after the economy expanded in the final quarter of last year. This is NPR. 26-year-old Azra Hussein was killed yesterday when an airplane collided with a helicopter near Washington, D.C. She was among 67 people who died. From member station WFIU, Ethan Sanwise spoke with the woman's husband.
Raised in Carmel, Indiana, Azra Hussein worked as a healthcare consultant. Her husband, Hamid Raza, said she had a vision to reform healthcare in America, and he feels she had more to give.
She was returning from a work trip where she was helping to improve a hospital that really needed help, and she was doing what she loved. She was even working on the flight.
Hussein and Raza met through the Muslim Student Association at Indiana University. They were married 2.5 years. For NPR News, I'm Ethan Sandweiss.
Dubai International Airport has recovered from the coronavirus pandemic that stopped global air travel 5 years ago. Officials say more than 92 million passengers walked through its terminals last year, making it the world's busiest for international travelers. India, however, still remains the top destination for international travelers, followed by Saudi Arabia and the United Kingdom. Authorities in Dubai are planning a nearly $35 billion upgrade for its main airport. On Wall Street, strong consumer spending led the economy to expand in the final quarter of 2024. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. It's been just over a year since Wichita celebrated a new direct flight route to Washington, D.C. Now the city is in mourning after a passenger plane flying that route collided with a helicopter last night, sending both aircraft into the Potomac River. It's believed that all 67 people on board the two aircraft have died. As Rose Conlin of member station KMUW reports, the Wichita community came together today for a prayer vigil.
We need you, Lord. We need you, Lord, right now.
Dozens of faith leaders and city officials and hundreds of residents gathered at the Wichita City Hall today to lead the community in prayer for those who lost their lives in the plane crash. That included Bishop Carl Kimmy of the Catholic Diocese of Wichita.
Hear our ardent and humble prayers, mighty God, that come from our community upon which has been visited this disaster and the loss of many lives.
Officials have not yet said how many Kansans were among the plane's passengers. U.S. Figure Skating has confirmed that several skaters, coaches, and their family members were on board the flight after Wichita hosted national championships last week.
Our Father, which are in heaven.
Wichita Mayor Lily Wu urged unity during the time of tragedy.
In memory of those who have lost their lives, in honor of the families that are grieving, I'm asking that we come together as Wichitans, as Kansans, and as Americans.
Pastor Albert Paredes with Praise Chapel Wichita led a prayer for families and friends of those who lost their lives and for first responders who continue to recover bodies from the Potomac River.
Lord, I pray, God, as we call upon your presence, that you, God, would bring comfort to every person in this room, to every person in this city, and to every person in this great country. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
After the prayer vigil, faith leaders and city officials gathered outside, where Rabbi Shmulek Greenberg with Chabad of Wichita said he was praying for a colleague's family member.
A Chabad colleague reached out back east and he said a family member from his congregation was on the crash. And so I said the Kilmali Rachmi prayer, which is the Jewish prayer for those who have deceased, and I said it for him and of course for all those who were part of this tragedy.
Also in the crowd was Dennis Balderas, a longtime North Wichita resident and a musician at the Pentecostal church New Hope Full Gospel Church. While he doesn't personally know anyone who was on the plane, he said the tragedy hits close to home.
You know, even my nephew works in Washington, D.C. She works for the White House, my nephew. And I was really shocked.
Sedgwick County Commissioner Ryan Beatty said the plane's passenger list has not been made public, but the crash has created deep pain in the local community.
We're hearing from constituents, we're hearing from family and friends that knew people that were on the plane. So those names are starting to come out via the community, and that's hard. That's hard.
He said Wichita has an opportunity to demonstrate how to love and mourn together at a time of deep national political division.
I think what the nation will see from Wichita is that they're going to see a community that rallies in love, a community that finds peace, a community that has joy even in the midst of despair, and a community that has kindness and gentleness.
But faith leaders here say, even so, it will take a long time for the community to reckon with such a tragedy. For NPR News, I'm Rose Conlin in Wichita.
President Trump's pick to lead the intelligence community, Tulsi Gabbard, faced a barrage of questions at her confirmation hearing this morning. Lawmakers were concerned she might clash with the intelligence officers she hopes to oversee. NPR's Jenna McLaughlin was watching and is with us to tell us what she heard. Hi, Jenna.
Hey, Sasha.
I want you to give us a little background of Tulsi Gabbard, because she is a Republican who wasn't always a Republican, which makes her especially interesting. Tell us about her.
That's correct, actually. She ran for president as a Democrat in 2020. She represented Hawaii in Congress for almost 10 years. She served in the Hawaii Army National Guard. She did a couple of tours overseas. Now she's a U.S. Army reservist. Now, Sasha, it's important to remember that Gabbard doesn't have a background in intelligence. That's kind of a concern, since she'd be in charge of 18 intelligence agencies and tens of billions of dollars. Her defense for that is that she's held a clearance for a long time in the military and in Congress on committees like the House Armed Services Committee, so she understands the importance of intelligence. Meanwhile, Gabbard's been really outspoken on her opinions on national security. Those range from criticizing the U.S. military intervening overseas to what she sees as intelligence failures, like the invasion of Iraq or the investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 election. It's a theme where she's found common ground with President Trump and his allies.
So all that puts her at odds with the intelligence community and its work right off the bat. Are there other positions she's taken that might intensify that bad blood?
Absolutely. And his name is Edward Snowden. One of the top questions senators had during the hearing was whether or not Gabbard thinks that the U.S. should drop all charges against Snowden, a position she previously took. He's the former NSA contractor who shared classified information about U.S. surveillance with journalists in 2013. Gabbard was very careful in her answers to those questions. Take a listen.
Edward Snowden broke the law. I do not agree with or support with all of the information and intelligence that he released, nor the way in which he did it. The fact is, he also, even as he broke the law, released information that exposed egregious, illegal, and unconstitutional programs.
The lawmakers interrupted her answers to that question on several occasions when she refused to label him as a traitor. Gabbard also got a bit of flack for a bill she introduced in 2020 that would have gut a key intelligence gathering program, Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. But she reassured senators that she would protect those authorities going forward.
Since we're talking about foreign policy issues here, would you give us an overview of her other positions on U.S. foreign policy?
Sure. One of the big ones to keep in mind is Syria. Gabbard met with then Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in 2017, a leader who is believed to be responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Syrian civilians. She's also contradicted the intelligence community's assessment that Assad used chemical weapons against his own citizens. During the hearing, Gabbard said she had no love for Assad or other dictators. She said her main focus is fighting terrorism. But, you know, she repeatedly defended her earlier positions, arguing there was competing evidence about chemical weapons at the time. Senator Mark Kelly of Arizona really pushed her on that, though. He basically got her to admit that she bought into arguments made by experts who had sketchy records, worrying ties to Russia. He dismantled the reasoning behind her skepticism, and she honestly didn't have much of a response for that.
On the Russia issue, has she said anything about Putin and Russia's war in Ukraine?
Yeah, Gabbard has faced a lot of criticism for making excuses for Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Even so, when she was directly asked who was responsible, Gabbard was unequivocal.
Putin started the war in Ukraine.
But, you know, it'll probably take more than that to reassure the intelligence community. They've spent the last many years documenting Russia's threats to global security, from the brutal invasion of Ukraine to poisoning dissidents and launching hacking campaigns. She has an uphill battle in gaining trust from the people she wants to lead.
That's NPR's Jenna McLaughlin. Thanks, Jenna.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Now, some news about public media. The new head of the Federal Communications Commission under President Trump has ordered an investigation of NPR and PBS. He is focusing on the corporate underwriting spots that you hear on shows like this one. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik joins me now. And before I bring in David, I do want to note NPR has rules for reporting when we report on ourselves. Among them, no corporate official, no news executive has had a hand in this coverage. With that, David, what is this investigation about?
Well, Mary Louise, on its face, involves concerns raised by the new FCC chairman, Brendan Carr, elevated by President Trump to that position, about the question of whether our underwriting spots, just as you say, the ones that we hear on shows like this on NPR and on PBS stations as well, are veering into becoming, crossing the lines, in fact, into becoming prohibited commercial advertisements. So, for example, if you hear something like Toyota, you know, is underwriting NPR and stations like this, they can't say, go buy a Tercel or some other Toyota car. They can say, you can learn more on our website, and here's what you can do. You can't have a call for action, and there are other restrictions as well. And that's what he's doing there. It's worth also remembering the FCC doesn't directly regulate the networks like NPR and PBS. What it does is regulate the member stations, which even in this digital age have to get licenses approved by the FCC to broadcast their, you know, and use airwaves that are owned otherwise by the public.
What have NPR and PBS said in response to this investigation?
Well, it's my chance, as always, Mary Louise, to point out I'm not speaking for NPR. I'm just the guy paid by NPR to cover it. But our chief executive, Catherine Mayer, as well as the head of PBS, Paula Kerger, both say, look, our programming and our underwriting messages comply with the law, they comply with federal regulations, and they comply, as we've tried to do for decades, with the guidelines that the FCC itself has given us to make sure that we're going on the straight and narrow, that we're staying within the rules. And both of them had said, essentially, that they're confident that this review or inquiry will ultimately affirm that they're adhering to these rules. These would have real consequences for our, you know, these 1,500 public broadcasting stations around the country that are licensed by the FCC. But, you know, they're saying we think that we do it right. And, you know, presumably if their tweaks are suggested, they would live with that, too.
David, just back up and give us a sense of the broader stakes here.
Well, I think it's really important. You know, in some ways, you've got this specific inquiry being raised by Chairman Carr, but it fits into his call, which he made expressly in his letters to the heads of NPR and of PBS, that he basically wants there to be an elimination of all government funding from the federal government for public broadcasting. And he said he's basically going to share what he finds with lawmakers on Capitol Hill as they debate that very issue. Trump tried without success several times to cut that funding during his first term in office. And it, of course, fits into this broader assault rhetorically by President Trump and his allies on the mainstream media. Trump has taken to the courts to go against major networks and major news organizations. He's, you know, made clear he intends to use bureaucratic regulatory levers as well. This is one of them. So you see this as, you know, really in some ways an attack on public broadcasting's federal funding and a questioning of its private funding and, you know, creating a more hostile climate for media writ large.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, thank you as always for your reporting.
You bet.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. All this week, we're featuring first-time Grammy nominees, as we do every year. And today, we're going to head down to Laguna Canyon, where we meet singer Radhika Vicaria.
Thank you so much for making the time.
Oh, everybody, thank you for coming.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, especially with everything that's going on, you know?
We had been reporting on the devastation of the L.A. fires earlier that same day and met Vicaria at a temple called Kali Mandir that's tucked away in a residential neighborhood. She's been returning to this temple time and time again over the last decade because of how it nurtures her.
It's been such a refuge, a place of a reset, everything that you would feel that your home should be, nourishing, safe, regrounding, all these things, and just full of love.
When you meet Vicaria, you get the sense that she too embodies those very qualities herself. And maybe that's why it's fitting that she conceived of her album Warriors of Light in this place.
Sure, okay. Yes, we can walk towards the altar, yeah.
She guides us to the main room, to a beautiful shrine dedicated to the goddess Kali.
You know, she's kind of all black and she might have her tongue sticking out and all this and she's dancing wildly and she has many different facets to her, but Kali really is unconditional love. She's unconditional love. She's the one that will banish your ignorance, really. She's the dispeller of your ego.
So during quiet moments, if you find yourself kneeling before this shrine, where do the thoughts in your head travel? Like, what do you think about? What do you process when you sit here?
Well, the first thing I do when I come here is I bow my head and I touch my head on the floor. That's the first thing. The reason why we do that is because when you bow or you prostrate, your head becomes lower than your heart. So think about that for a second, right?
Yeah.
You're really leading with your heart at that point. So your ego gets dissolved on the floor. You put it in the ground.
This song, Kali, was the first track that Vicaria wrote for this album, which is now nominated for a Grammy Award for Best New Age Ambient or Chant Album.
And I hadn't even really thought of the full album at that point. I was just moved to connect with Ma Kali, and that song is what came about. And you know, being here and being at the events that have taken place here, the music, the devotion, this place has been an anchor point for my life through some of the tough things that I've been through.
Vicaria was raised in the UK by Indian parents who were born in Kenya. She says her father came to London with only 300 pounds, a suitcase, and a beautiful, beautiful singing voice. So all through her life, the family home was filled with music.
I was around music from even, you know, when I was in the womb, my parents were having music parties in their homes. Like, we weren't rich. We had a little three-bedroom house, but my parents' friends all were musicians. And they would come and bring their instruments up to dinner. They just knock on the door and, you know, several times a week, just after dinner, we'd just have all these random people in our house just playing music.
I love it. And would your parents joke as you were growing up, telling you, you know, you were listening to music when you were in utero?
Oh, absolutely. When you grow up in England as an Indian heritage kid, even though you're in England, I had this beautiful mix of this Western upbringing, but this kind of rooted kind of remembering of my ancestors and that culture in the home. So I feel very fortunate that I got the best of all the worlds. And so I would hear, you know, mantras and devotional music when you're little, because you'd go to ceremonies or, you know, rituals or holidays. And I would pick up mantras and melodies before I could speak English.
Wow, it was so intuitive.
Singing, yeah, I was going to that before I could even speak English.
भूत पिसाच निकट नहीं आवे महावीर जब नाम सुनावे ना से रोग हरे सब पीरा.
Can I share something with you, please? I was listening to your music for the first time this week in my office at NPR West, and I had the volume on pretty loudly, and it wasn't until, you know, minutes into this album that I kind of poked my head out the door and I apologized to everyone for turning up the music so loudly. And I realized that people thought I was listening to your music to find a sense of calm during this terrible week that Los Angeles has gone through with these huge fires. And it made me connect within that moment that not only is your music so healing, but there is something truly spiritual about it. And so I was curious, like, when you are making the music, does it feel like a spiritual experience as it's coming out of you?
When I'm singing, yes.
Yeah.
I often cry.
Asht Siddhi Navanidhi Ke Data Asvar Deen Jaan Ki Mata Ram Rasayan Tumhare Paasa.
Now I've realized that my measure of having recorded it well is if I cry, it's good. If I don't cry, it's not. So, because there's such immense emotion and there's such power and potency, it's often a bit overwhelming after I've finished recording. Like if I'm having a day where there's too much going on in the mind, if it's going to obstruct what's going to be there, then I don't do it. But that's very rare. Oftentimes I come to the microphone, I sing, and everything is just taken care of. Like it's just, wow. It immediately resets me.
She invites us to share that experience with her. So before we leave, we walk back to the shrine and sit cross-legged on the floor.
This is a harmonium.
And two monks join her on drums. Radhika Vakharia. She's nominated for a Grammy for Best New Age Ambient or Chant Album.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive. Progressive Commercial Auto Insurance protects the vehicles that work to keep small businesses moving forward, including protection while running errands and other tasks, at progressivecommercial.com. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. From Dignity Memorial, helping families protect their loved ones and gain peace of mind by planning cremations and funerals in advance. Dedicated to professionalism and compassion in every detail. More at dignitymemorial.com.